Hello and welcome to the program. My name is Luke Hunt and this is another episode of Beyond the Mekong, which is broadcast by The Diplomat. And with me today is Chloe Riddell, who is a member of the European Parliament, and she's been asked to report to the Parliament on transnational repression, which is an enormous issue across the planet, in Europe, the Middle East, and in Asia. Chloe, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. Hello.
Tell me about this report and where are we today? I've been reading in about particularly the Freedom House reports, which tell a horrible picture about what is happening in regards to transnational repression. Can you bring us up to date? What is happening in the EU?
Yeah, well, transnational repression is a growing phenomenon. It's a deliberate strategy from authoritarian regimes, government to coerce, control, or silence their critics abroad, right? And this is a kind of, I call it a globalization of authoritarianism, of tyranny. And actually, Europe is its preferred hunting ground because we can see that more than 20% of all acts of transnational repression are happening in the EU. And we cannot let that happen anymore. We lack a lot of knowledge about what is really transnational repression and how to fight it. And actually, if you look at the number and the number of Freedom House you've just mentioned, there are 10 countries in the world that are responsible for 80% of all abuses as transnational repression, namely these are China, Russia, Turkey, Iran, Tajikistan, Egypt, Belarus, Turkmenistan, and Uzbekistan. And there is also, yes, Cambodia. So it's a very concentrated phenomenon, but it's growing. And it is, in our sovereignty force, matter of security. And it is in our democratic interest, you know, to be able to protect those who are seeking asylum, who are living in Europe, but still are being pursued by their original regime. And we need to act because we cannot, stand anymore than that those authoritarian regimes come to our streets and just threaten individuals like that. So yeah, in this report, I give first a definition of what transnational repression is because there was no definition whatsoever in the European law or international law.
Right.
And I try to describe the phenomenon and way to fight it.
Right. Now, we've seen this happen in Southeast Asia for quite some time. And there was the forced repatriation of Uyghurs back to China out of Thailand, which was quite nasty in February. Vietnam's relationship with Germany is quite bad because of the abduction of Vietnamese people out of Germany. It has been going on for quite some time. And I think in your press statements and in other reports, it's been mentioned that Canada, UK, Australia, these countries are actually ahead of the game in terms of defining transnational repression, but the EU has to catch up.
Well, actually, you're right that Australia, Canada, and the US are very advanced when it comes to fighting transnational repression. They have really taken the issue seriously and they've put means to fight it. Whereas in the European Union, we have some tools, but they are very weak and we lack coordination, really, between different member states to fight transnational repression. So in my report, for instance, it said that in every national administration, you have a contact point that is dealing with transnational repression, and all of them are coordinated, notably by Europol, which is a European agency, but an agency that has no competence whatsoever in transnational repression. Europol is competent, is entitled with fighting terrorism, for instance, organized crime. but not transnational requests. So in my report, I suggest that we enlarge the mandate of Europol so that it can also, work on transnational repression and help to gather some data about what is happening. Because sometimes, can you imagine that the only data we have on transnational repression comes from an NGO called Freedom House and not from our governments, right? So we need to have some data because we feel that the phenomenon is growing, but we have no clear picture of it.
One of the reasons I ask is because ASEAN, the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, has often had pretensions to being like the European Union. And what we're seeing in ASEAN and what NGOs like Human Rights Watch have put forward is that too many governments within ASEAN, in particular the Cambodians, the Thai government under previous administrations, the Vietnamese and the Lao, have actually done secret deals among themselves to deal with political activists who have sought refuge in neighbouring countries. And I'm kind of wondering if you have these sorts of issues as well within the European Union.
Different, in the European Union than in East Asia. It's true that there is an annoying trend. In East Asia, where we can see in Cambodia, in Thailand, you've just mentioned, in Vietnam, a kind of, tendent to not protect foreign people who seek, asylum and refuge in their countries. They are under a lot of pressure because they are, also from China, which is their biggest neighbors and one of the biggest perpetrators of transnational repression all around the world. I think that China accounts for 20% of all acts of transnational repression alone. So it's very, huge. It's a straight government strategy in China. So those countries in East Asia are very victims also of that. But we need to say that we refuse kind of repression that takes many, many different forms. You have, transnational repression beyond borders can target human rights defenders, journalists, Gapara communities, political opponents, and states are the main perpetrators, but they often rely on what we call proxies, such as private companies, criminal networks, or, diaspora collaborators. And you have a lot of tactics that include physical threats, enforced disappearance, assassination, of course, poisoning, forced repatriation, as we've seen with Uyghurs from Thailand.
Yep.
Extradition requests also, and the abuse of Interpol red notices for political motives. It is a very serious threat in Europe. For instance, in Europe, you have from Tajikistan more than 200 Interpol red notices that target human rights defenders that are living, in Europe. And we have to see when an Interpol red notice that is supposed to, deal with big terrorists and big criminals is abusive or not. And in my report, I suggest that Europol have a say on that and can assess the abusive nature or not of Interpol red notices, because currently states in the EU are doing whatever they want. And we had the recent case with Paul Watson. Maybe you know him. So he's a very famous whale defender, right? Very famous in France, indeed. He used to live in Germany freely, used to live in France, and he was arrested in Greenland, by Denmark authorities based on an Interpol red notice that was clearly an abusive one. So we need a better coordination, European coordination, when it comes to that. But
I've been hearing quite a few complaints about Interpol, and it's all we have. But is Interpol fit for purpose in terms of combating transnational repression?
No, not. Interpol said he was fighting, abusive red notices, but the problem is still there. The problem is still there, and you have a lot of red notices by Interpol and also blue notice notices that are abusive and that targets abusively human rights defenders and political opponents. So we cannot rely on Interpol to fight to hit it. But we have to, you know, organize as states and as the European Union to say, okay, this is abusive and we should not execute this Interpol red notice. But this is actually one of the biggest means for transnational repression on those red notices. Yeah, we also need to be aware that transnational repression can take also various forms of administrative pressure, for instance, travel bans, the denial of identity documents, consular services, all of that. And to finally, there is also, of course, a digital transnational repression with online surveillance, hacking, spyware, doxing, harassment and social media. That is very challenging these days.
You mentioned transnational crime before. Is transnational repression growing in tandem with transnational crime? And I ask that because of what's happened in terms of human trafficking, scam compounds, which was industrialized to an extraordinary level out of Cambodia during the COVID pandemic. And are you seeing links between transnational criminals and the crime syndicates and transnational repression?
Oh, yeah. Well, yes, there is. But we need to, you know, we need to investigate a lot more. But of course, when you are a state and you want to target people abroad outside your national frontier, you need European people to do that for you, right? So you rely on, your own services. I take the example, for instance, of what Russia is doing. Sometimes you have Russian agents, you know, that can come to Europe and poison and assassinate people. We've seen that before. But they can also rely on some national criminal organizations that are doing the dirty job. So, of course, they are big proxies of transnational repression today, enablers of transnational repression. And we have also, for instance, spyware companies, so, you know, companies that are building spyware, creating spyware. We know that technology can have good or bad use, but, you know, a spyware is dedicated to surveil somebody. And in my reports, I also demand that we ban exports of spyware to authoritarian regimes. I mean, we cannot allow an EU mandate to allow the export of spyware to authoritarian regime, because we know that in that case, the spyware will be used against us and against human rights defenders. It's not our interest. So in front of all of that, we need to spot those who can be victims of transnational repression that are living in our countries and alert them against those transnational criminals, those spyware. We have to train them to protect their phones and computers from spyware. It's a whole like security, cyber security training that we could provide them, you know. But
so it takes means and an administration to take care of that.
You were talking about protective custody. It's an extraordinary move, though, to have a part of your community that needs to be trained up in this kind of hardware, software, in order to protect them from outside forces.
Sure, I mean, but this is necessary. But because, for instance, sometimes you have human rights defenders that are being surveilled, that are being followed, but they don't know that. Okay, so they need a police service to say, hey, you are being surveilled, you know, by your country of origin, this can be dangerous for you. You know, in the course of my report and the work I have done, I've met with various human rights defenders that are, you know, refugees in Europe. And for instance, I've met with the Russian diaspora and a man called Ilya Yetin, who is a very famous Russian opponent. He used to be a good friend of Boris Nemtsov, who was assassinated by Putin back in 2015. And he just went out of prison in Russia because he criticized the war in Ukraine. So he was in jail for 2 years in Russia, and he was freed
by an exchange of prisoner between Russia and Germany, I think, and now he lives in Germany, right? And this guy is very important figure of Russian opposition living in Europe. And he also worked with a bunch of journalists, because you have to know that 90 newspapers from Russia are now operating from Europe so that they can still be free, you know, and speak to Russian people freely. So it is in our deep interest to protect those people and allow them to do their work. And Ilya, I mean, his fault is surveilled, okay? And he needs the protection of German police, and that German police can help him know if there is any spyware on his phone, because those things are invisible, okay? But they can see all your conversations, emails, and stuff. So, yeah. Challenging, because with the new digital tools today, you can really do a lot from far away and control and try to coerce and silence political opposition and democratic leaders.
Yeah, it's quite remarkable. I was up on the Thai-Myanmar border recently, where the Thais have initiated a crackdown on the scam compounds and the human trafficking. And the stories I have out of there in regards to the technology that these transnational crime syndicates have, they're absolutely extraordinary. And I think perhaps the strangest sight was when the Thais cut the internet connection, the crime syndicates ordered en masse Elon Musk's Starlink system so they could carry on their work. And they were just buying them en masse from department stores in Bangkok. It's kind of, at one end you have the extraordinary tools of the trade, and at the other end they're buying them from ordinary supermarkets where they can carry out their work, for want of a better word.
Yeah, cool. I mean, this is why, you know, we need to evaluate this phenomenon and to regulate this market of spyware and all the people enablers of digital transnational repression. You have artificial intelligence that is now also a new tool for, you know, making videos to harass, to dox, especially women as well, with pornographic content, you know, being spread about them. So we need to hold the social media platform accountable as well, because they are today enablers de facto of transnational repression, and they are not doing enough to fight it.
Right.
So, in Europe, we had the tool called the Digital Services Act, and we need to enforce it properly.
Right. And that means Mark Zuckerberg, Facebook, Instagram, these sorts of platforms that everyday people use. Is it possible that the EU could in future take into account transnational repression when negotiating, say, a free trade agreement, when it comes to diplomacy with other countries? The Vietnamese abduction of Trinh Xuan Thanh, the Vietnamese dissident who was living in Germany, has sunk relations between the two to a very low level. And I'm wondering if the globalized world that followed the end of the Cold War is well and truly over, but could we be looking at a much harder attitude towards authoritarian regimes going forward?
Sure. The EU need to really put forward transnational repression as a key concern and to mention it in every, you know, dialogue it has with some countries. This is a key priority in my report. We have a human rights dialogue, for instance. We have dialogues and we sign trade agreements with a lot of countries in the world, and we need to make transnational repression a specific concern and include it in the clause we put on human rights in our agreements. We should also enlarge the EU sanctioned mechanism for that. It includes transnational repression as well, so that we can put forward sanctions on the basis, I mean, of transnational repression and sanctioned governments that are, you know, engaging in that.
Right. Is there a sense in the EU that it must take the lead on this? I'm hearing from many quarters that the arrival of Donald Trump too in the White House, and we all know what's happened over the past 4 or 5 months, that people, pro-democracy activists, journalists, given the closure of VOA and its affiliates in Europe, and rights activists of all stripes, are looking to the EU and Australia and Canada and the UK for their inspiration. Is there a sense of urgency in the EU that they have to get on with this now, given that no one expects too much help to be coming from the Americans?
That for sure, and we do it now as well, because we can see that there is a growing trend of authoritarianism around the world, and we have to protect our democracies, our values, and all the people who fight for democracy around the world, whatever they come from. And transnational repression actually seek to silence those people. It is in our interest to protect. So I think there is prise de conscience, weapon to wear this about transnational repression. It was discussed in the recent G7 meetings. And the US actually, before Trump, but was very advanced when it comes to fight transnational repression. FBI had a special unit, and all was very, they were very sharp and had a coordinated action through also the embassy throughout the world. So we need to take that as an inspiration to better structure ourselves. We have also European representation throughout the world, delegation, we call them. And in each of them, we should have, at least the delegation that are located in the countries that are transnational repression perpetrators, to have, someone responsible for transnational repression to collect deadlines and to protect human rights defender, yeah.
To combat this, in that I've seen this in terms of transnational crime. If it's going to end, and I doubt it will, I think the best that the governments can do is control it. But it requires the Chinese to talk to the Americans. It requires the Chinese to talk to the Cambodians, and the Cambodians are not listening. Thailand is a country in Southeast Asia which is torn between China and America. And these sorts of relationships, to my mind, just seems to make it all the more harder. And then with the Americans and Trump, I am wondering, are they continuing to share information the way they used to?
Actually, I don't know.
Well, that is something.
All it curses is about it, but
right.
We don't know.
That is something in itself. What are the worst cases of transnational repression you've seen in Europe over the past few years?
Well, I've been one in my country against a Uyghurs diaspora. A girl called Jalilova, Gubila Jalilova, she was a survivor of concentration camps in China, Uyghur concentration camps. And last year, he was in her apartment in Paris, and there was a gathering of Chinese men dressed in black in her building, waiting for her and in front of her apartment, wanted to kidnap her. So this is an example. We've seen also in September 2016, for instance, some Iranian activists called Mehdi Kosravi that stepped off a plane in Rome and was brought into prison on the basis of a politically motivated capital raid noted by Iran, executed by Italy, so things can happen. You have a lot of cases also of people from Algeria after the Hirak, the citizen revolution that was happening in Algeria, that was then kicking refuge to Europe, and that were forced, deported. And back to Algeria and imprisoned there. So it was by Spain, who sent them back to Algeria. So there are a lot of cases, and we could mention poisoning by of people by Russia, even killing. So
yeah, I do wonder the poisoning of Litvinenko all those years ago in London by the Russians, that the response wasn't harsh enough. I mean, London was nuked by Russia twice, I think. And I look back and the response from the government of the day was very weak. Do you think we're paying for those sins now, in that these governments have been emboldened by their perceived successes of the past?
You know, they've found the means to do whatever they want in Europe, because, you know, we have a big trade relations with them. So China is always balancing human rights with those trade relations. And this is why we have to de-risk
our economy from China. I don't know if it's good English to say that.
No, you're quite right. It's a similar issue out
here. We are being blackmailed, you know, by those regimes. So we need to be aware of that. And I mean, with Iran, of course, it's a big problem. Iran is kidnapping a lot of our European national that are taking hostage, you know, by Iran as a mean of blackmailing as well. We have, of course, Russia. But we have to be aware that now, I mean, this is a kind of hybrid war, you know, against Europe and its values. So we have to fight it, yeah.
It's a difficult one. You mentioned a Ukrainian dissident before. I am wondering about the broader Ukrainian diaspora in Europe and how they are faring against the Russians, given that it's all shared borders.
Yeah, it's true that we have millions of Ukrainian refugees in Europe, and that, you know, that they can be victims of transnational repression from either Russia or Belarus. We have also, as I said before, political opponent from Russia here in Europe. I was talking about Ilya Yashin, but he's not the only one.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, when you know that Putin is trying to do some, I mean, he's doing some propaganda against his own people. There is no free press anymore in Russia. We know it. And there is a kind of war for the control of minds, you know, in Russia. And Putin had understood before many others that the control of spirits and minds was key. And one of the tools we have as European to fight this mind control war to ensure that Russian people still have access to free press and free information, the way we can do that is by enabling those Russian journalists and diaspora in Europe to do his job, you know, to do their job, and to try to still speak to the Russian people from our side, you know? And yep. So
it's an interesting phenomena. Again, I'm coming back to Donald Trump, who has cut funding for groups like Voice of America and in Europe and elsewhere as well. But there's a lot of journalists who have lost their jobs because of that. And these were the people reporting on conflicts in Myanmar, trying to tell the truth about what is happening in Cambodia. There is a complete absence of reportage in regards to China. And I am wondering if the EU is looking more and more at stepping into this void that the Americans have left in terms of funding.
Oh, I mean, we can, yeah, I mean, We talk about filling the void left by USAID, for instance, in development funding, USAID, and also filling up the void when it comes to protecting freedom and protecting human rights defenders all around the world. So this is a key priority for us and for our group in the European Parliament, the Socialists and Democrats group. But as you can notice, as you can see, Ursula von der Leyen has presented the budget this week for the multi-annual financial framework for Europe. And unfortunately, it's not as what we could expect, you know, if we had to fill that void you just mentioned.
Yep.
We need to do more. We don't need a budget that is 1% of Europe GDP only. So yeah, there's still a long way so that European Union can take more responsibility throughout the world. It's sure, but we can notice that there is an expectation. There are expectations from us to act, but still a long way to go.
Yeah, indeed. What happens next with your report? What, where does it go, and how do you think your colleagues will react?
Well, actually, there was a very good reaction from all political groups to the report when I presented the draft. So we can have good hopes that there is a bold majority behind that report. Now, after I presented the draft in June, there were some amendments that were tabled, and we are going to vote on the report in October in the Foreign Affairs Committee of the European Parliament, and then the report would be voted at the plenary session of the European Parliament at the end of November. So we can have, you know, a roadmap for European institutions to act and aim. I hope that reports will inspire the European Commission and national governments to really change the way we act against transnational repression and the way we collect data on it, and we take this problem very seriously.
Right, and that could have ramifications, obviously not just in Europe, but for countries like China. I notice India is being cited as a country that has gone on the road of transnational repression, but also the smaller countries like Cambodia and Thailand. I guess this could have ramifications for everybody, I think, is what you're saying.
Yes, I mean, people have ramifications for every country in the world that commits transnational repression, and we should also send a strong signal that now to those countries that are perpetrators of transnational repression, that now European Union is taking it very seriously and is going to organize itself to fight it back.
And on that note, Chloe Riddell, thank you very much. It's been a delightful chat.
Thank you very much to you. It's been a pleasure for me too. And thank you for your interest in this very important topic.